From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojun Amdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer at the Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Juanica Fisher. She is an assistant majority leader, the assistant majority leader in the Maryland House of Delegates. Joining us in studio now is Elissa Silverman. She is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. Elissa Silverman, welcome.
Good afternoon, Kojo and Tom. Great to be here.
Before we get to matters of the District of Columbia, Tom Sherwood, let's get to matters of Metro and Arlington County, where Arlington County Board Member Christian Dorsey has resigned from the Metro Board. It all started with a $10,000 contribution he got from a union that represents Metro workers, and he failed to report that contribution on time. He has still not been able to return the contribution at this point, but because he failed to report it on time, he is now a former Metro board member.
Yes, he resigned this week. The union, the Amalgamated Transit Union, represents 13,000 workers, and he was on the finance board of Metro, and he was making decisions about finances that affected the union, and he had not told Metro that he had got this contribution. He did report it on his Arlington County ethics report. Well, you know, last week on this program, Arlington Board Chairman Libby Garvey was sitting right here, and we asked her about this, and she said it was all done, that she thought it was that he had taken care of the $10,000 thing, and he was doing a good job as the Northern Virginia representative on Metro, and so
that he probably resigned. Have to resign. Yes.
Well, I spoke to Ms. Garvey on the phone today. She's down in Richmond, but on the way into the studio, I spoke to her on the phone. And she said that this was a surprise to her that the check, he had not cleared up the check, that she was, quote, deeply disappointed, that she is going to have a sit-down meeting with him to make certain that his personal financial issues, and it appears to be this is what it is, he simply he filed for bankruptcy. She wants to make certain that he has not done anything that is affecting his work on the Arlington board. Not just Metro. She says she's not aware of anything, that she thinks he is can still be a good board member on the Arlington
board. And that's one of the factors here. The members of both the Metro Board and the Arlington County Board seem to have a great deal of respect for Christian Dorsey. And in a way, that's why he was kind of given a pass, wasn't it?
It is. And yes, and some people who are, well, I won't get into all those details. Yes, the fact is he is well-liked. He was considered a very effective member on the board. But there's so much the case where a person's public life can be quite sterling and quite praiseworthy. And then in private, their lives are going off the rails.
And well, in this case, Silverman, we talked about the fact that he said that one of the reasons he had to declare bankruptcy was because they don't get paid a great deal on the Arlington County and County Council. And Libby Garvey agreed. She said they do not get paid enough. I think that stands in, some would say, stark contrast to what the D.C. Council is paid, because the D.C. Council is more like a full-time job in a state position.
No, it's true. I have worked with Christian Dorsey and was surprised to read both about the public issues and private issues, private financial issues. The Arlington County Board is a 5-member board. I think they earn about $60,000 a year.
I think it's closer to 50.
Okay.
The chairperson may make close to 60.
And actually, I have had discussions with Mr. Dorsey about this. I mean, it's pretty much a full-time job. It's a jurisdiction that has a very high cost of living, just like the district. But Arlington County board members make about less than half of what district council members make. So I think it is a serious issue. I think all the Arlington County board members either have part-time work or have a spouse that earns a living that helps compensate for their lower salary.
But whatever the salary is, he failed to disclose accepting $10,000 from the transit union. And I still have not heard a good explanation as to why. He put it on his Arlington board report, but he didn't put it on the Metro Even after all that with Jack Evans last year, he still didn't do it. That's astonishing.
It is. It is. I mean, I know, Tom, you always say disclosure, disclosure, disclosure.
Yes, you've quoted me accurately.
We need to have an open, transparent reporting of campaign contributions. And there have been more questions raised, I think I read in the Post, that he claims he sent a check and now the check is lost. And those, you know, those type of answers just raise more questions.
Yeah, that's an inadequate response. And now the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, which appoints, picks the person for the person on the board, now will meet in March to pick someone new.
Now on to the name of the Washington football team. The Redskins is considered a slur, according to the dictionary, but several studies in the past have essentially said that, several polls in the past have essentially said that, well, only about 1 in 10 Native Americans are object to the name. Well, the University of California, Berkeley, says that those previous studies had little methodological transparency. The study that they have conducted has shown almost 50% of Native Americans around the country think both the name and the tomahawk chop that we see by teams like the Kansas City Chiefs are considered objectionable as far as Native Americans are concerned. Will it make a difference?
Well, it makes a difference. You know, the Supreme Court ruled that, you know, the names that are offensive to others are not, you can't, by law, tell them you can't have them. But, you know, the Post had a report, and I think I've forgotten the other organization that had a study, that it said many Native Americans, a majority, something like 60% or something, were not offended by the name. They didn't particularly like it, but they weren't offended by it. And so these two professors, one from the University of Michigan and one from the University of Berkeley, did a survey. They did 1,000 people who identified as Native American. But I must say, even here in this study, it showed that 50% of these folks were offended by the name, and about half were not. But if you drill down and people who identify as Native American, it's more like 67 to 70% of them don't like the name. I mean, if you watch the Super Bowl, and I know, Kojo, you love the Super Bowl and watch it every year.
Rooting for Kansas City, too.
Kansas City Chiefs there, you know, it's just stunning to see that
Kansas
crowd.
Kansas City, Missouri, that is.
It is Missouri, Mr. President, not Kansas. But you know, you saw the crowd do the tomahawk chalk, and I always thought it was the Atlanta Braves who did it. And
Kojo, my take on this is that it's an objectionable name and a more objectionable owner. I do want to go
We're
back to
the owner's more objectionable than the name.
Team, the team of our skins. Team. Yes. I do want to go back to the Metro. Maybe I'm a step slow today, but Metro is so critical, and so I am glad that Mr. Dorsey stepped aside, because we need to have leadership that we can trust at Metro, especially at this time.
So on the team, you know, every mayor since Tony Williams. Well, we did Metro. We're moving on now. Every mayor since Tony Williams has supported bringing the team back. If the team spends its own money to build a new stadium at the RFK site, there would be substantial cost to the city to prepare the land if it got permission from the federal government to use the land. Where are you on this? Or would you support a team coming back if it built its own stadium?
So there's a lot that's unknown about building our own stadium. I'm not supportive of building an NFL stadium. I think there's a lot of other uses right now.
You're a big fan of the Washington Nationals, and the city spent $800 million on that.
So I'm supportive of having major league sports teams here, but I think many cities have learned that we don't have to just hand over our checkbook in order to bring teams here.
Would you be willing to look at a potential move here based if it were good for the district first and did not cost an outrageous
amount? I don't
want
to see the expenditure of taxpayer dollars going toward an NFL team. I would take a look, but I think that we have a lot of critical issues that we need to spend money on. We need to spend money on education, on housing, making our streets safe.
Let's talk
housing.
The
NFL is pretty low on that list for me.
Alyssa Silverman is our guest. She's an at-large member of the D.C. Council. If you have questions or comments for her, give us a call, 800-433-8850. As I said, let's talk housing. More than a third of the housing managed by the D.C. Housing Authority is in need of repair. to address this, the authority has drawn up a 20-year, what it calls, transformation plan. In a recent public hearing on the project, you expressed concerns about the authority's ability to redevelop these properties. What are you worried about?
I am worried that the housing authority...
It would be easier for her to answer what she's not worried about, right?
I was shown the cough button earlier, Tom. So I'm concerned, Kodjo, that the housing authority is not true to its mission, which is to provide housing for our lowest income residents, for working poor in this city, and that in making decisions about how they're going to redevelop their properties, they might have the interests of developers more in mind than of the residents who they are supposed to house in our city. I know this is an issue that a lot of people aren't that familiar with.
True.
So Metro is actually a very good analogy. The crisis that we're in with our public housing authority is much like Metro. It's absolutely critical to our city, especially for the most vulnerable residents of our city. There are declining federal resources, and there are very severe health and safety issues right now. My concern is that the Housing Authority's board has made some recent decisions that suggest that it is drifting away, not just drifting away, pretty much abandoning what its mission is, which is to provide housing for our lowest income residents. And the example that I would cite is decision-making they made around their recent headquarters redevelopment.
Exactly. I'm going to go to both. I'm going to go to that in a second. But your colleague, Councilmember Brianne Nadeau, has introduced a bill to do exactly what you want, to protect public housing tenants from displacement. She's also introduced a bill to stop the D.C. Housing Authority from being independent and to strip it of its independent status and to make it a part of the mayor's office. And that has a lot to do with the issue that you want to talk about, which is their headquarters.
Right. There's a lot in there. So let me try to unpack this, Kodjo. So the just like Metro.
In 2 minutes or less.
The Housing Authority is an independent agency. It's right now not a part of district government. But the problem is that the Housing Authority is making critical decisions about our residents and about our housing stock that really impacts all of us. So the question is, what should we do? We need the authority to make its decisions in a way that is open and transparent and understandable and in the public's interest. And right now, I don't think that's the case. There is something, so they are making decisions about not only their headquarters, which is a very valuable piece of land right next to the new NPR headquarters, in fact, right near Union Station, Jobs, Harris Teeter, and so forth, very valuable plot of land, as well as 14 housing communities, public housing communities that they say are in urgent need of repair. Now, these are not properties. These properties are very desirable, Kodjo, to developers.
This is where we get into the politics of this
right,
issue.
So the
developers are feasting at the public housing trough.
Well, what I would say, Tom, is that these are properties like Greenleaf, which is right next to the baseball stadium, areas that look very different than they did 20 years ago, and that under a redevelopment plan might be very attractive to developers. What we need to safeguard is the housing, what we call deeply affordable housing, housing for are working poor, for people who are critical to our economy. They're working at Potbelly across the street. They're working at CVS. They're flaggers in construction projects. They need a place to live in our city, Kodjo. And the Housing Authority is our best tool to provide that housing. But what's happening, and 1133 North Capitol Street is the example, is that in the end, the Housing Authority has proposed a deal which would not benefit public housing residents. I think it's largely a giveaway to developers that could cost the Housing Authority money in the end. So we're going to get no housing for our poorest residents. We're going to give money to developers, a lease back, it's called, $14 million lease back for their headquarters. And in the end, we're not going to get what we want, which is deeply affordable housing to make our city racially equitable.
Is this a problem because the federal government has gotten out of subsidizing public housing? And or is it more that this has been a politically clueless board in terms of providing the services you just described? Is the board itself, I think there are developers on the board, business people on the board. You've suggested that it ought to be a board that wants to build public housing, not develop property.
So there are declining federal resources, and the question for the city is, do we fill in the gap? Once again, much like Metro, we need housing for people who earn the minimum wage. We have a board that I think hasn't functioned properly. It is not transparent in how they make decisions. The example I'll give is that on this redevelopment decision about its own headquarters, even board members were saying, we don't know what's in the deal. We want to talk to the developers to understand, well, what are we getting for this very valuable piece of land? And they couldn't get answers. That's not making decisions in the public's interest.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion with Alyssa Silverman, at-large member of the D.C. Council. I'm Kojo Nan.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back to the Politics Hour with Tom Sherwood. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Juanica Fisher, Assistant Majority Leader in the Maryland House of Delegates. We're currently talking with Alyssa Silverman. This week, you opposed a resolution to back a local group seeking to operate three public golf courses. Councilmember Kenyon McDuffie suggested that you were unfairly rejecting local and minority-owned businesses. What's going on here?
Okay, so this is a small issue that gets to a bigger one. One of my core values is having a transparent, open, fair procurement process. So what we're talking about is there are three golf courses in a tennis center that is owned by the federal government and run by a contractor to the Park Service. Right now, there's a competitive bid process, which is generally a best practice of
government.
We're
talking federal. Rock Creek, East Potomac, and Langston.
And Langston Golf Course.
It's a federal
process. It's a federal competitive bid process in order to determine who will run, who will operate these golf courses and the tennis center. My values, Kojo, are that we should have an open, transparent, competitive process and let that process determine who is the best contractor that will provide the best service for the best price. Right now, the bid process is still open. So there might be more than one local Black-owned, women-owned, what we call a CBE, certified business enterprise, that might be interested in bidding on this contract. And what we were doing so on Tuesday, we approved a sense of the council. I voted against it just because I feel like I don't know if there might be another local bidder. And I didn't want to, tip the scales toward one local bidder when there might be several that decide to put in a bid for the contract.
Let's bring the politics into this. It's not just a bidder. The Federal City Council, which has been around since the 50s, is an organization of
headed by former Mayor Anthony Williams,
run by Tony Williams now. It put together a nonprofit to bid on these golf courses, saying that it's a local person and it could run these golf courses for the benefit of the community and the people who use them, spend money to fix them up and make them an asset as opposed to a liability. Are you concerned about the federal city council being involved at all, not just an open process, but are you concerned about the federal city council being involved?
No, my primary concern is we don't know who the bidders are, and we
As I understand, the other bidder is somebody from Phoenix, Arizona, and not a local bidder.
The process is still open.
Until February 28th.
That's my understanding. So somebody might not have submitted a bid yet.
So would you support it maybe after February 28th?
Yes, and that's the point. It's more about the process in that if we're going to have a competitive process, we shouldn't foreclose on other local minority-owned businesses that might have experience running sports facilities who might be interested in bidding on
the contract. The politics of this is that Kenyon McDuffie, the chairman of the council, Mr. Mendelson, others have said that when you talked about the council putting its thumb on the scale to support the federal city council, that that was an example of how you are viewed as anti-business and you are difficult to get along with because you see corruption and everything that happens in business. So what businesses do you support?
So I think this,
and answer that.
She mentioned CBEs. But,
so I think this is a vignette in search of controversy here, Tom.
A vignette.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I mean,
I believe in competitive bidding. Okay. I think that competitive bidding.
Are you
bidding,
anti-business?
No, not at all. Okay. And I have, I think that the comments that were made were inappropriate. I mean, all I said was, it's a best practice in procuring government services to have a competitive bid process. That process is open right now. We
Chairman
don't know
Mendelson
who the bidders are.
Chairman Mendelson
so why
said
should
last
we
night.
Show our bias toward one bidder when there might be another local bidder who might just have
Chairman
as
Mendelson said Russell. Last night that you, I think she hurt herself a little bit by staking out this position and not supporting the local bid in the city.
Look. Here's my take on this, Tom, is that, yes, I believe in a competitive, transparent process to procure goods and services. And there's a perception among our residents that our process, our government's process, is not always fair and open and transparent. And that was part of the investigation, which led to one of our members being threatened with expulsion. I think we have to be careful.
Speaking of that, here's Chris in Washington, D.C. Chris, jump in. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I just wanted to call. Thank you, Alyssa. You've been a stalwart for the people since your LL times and also with the Fiscal Policy Institute. I just want to thank you. Bottom line is, now that we're post Jack Evans and this kind of corrupt era, will you work to rescind some of the Evans-era terrible land deals, such as McMillan Park?
So I think this is the moment where I say that I'm this is Chris Otten. Thanks, Chris, for calling. It means that I really am on Kojo's program. I think we have to make sure that all of our land deals, as I said before, there's transparency in the process, that we're getting a good value for our taxpayer dollars. And so moving forward, Chris, I vow to you that that's the approach I will take.
Let me ask about, he's mentioned Jack Evans. You know, the council, 12 members, you among them, signed a letter disparaging or being concerned that Jack Evans resigned from the council on the threat of being expelled and then now is running for the same seats. Who initiated that letter? Was that your idea? It was sent out by the chairman and all 11 other members. Whose idea was that?
Well, I think there was a discussion among members and a
Was there a genesis of the person on the council?
There was a discussion by members of having one voice to say that we don't support Jack returning to the council.
Got it. Okay. So it was a group decision.
Yes, it was a group decision.
So no one, you didn't send out an email to everyone and say, let's do this. Are you going to endorse someone in the Ward 2 race?
So I've met with most of the candidates, and I will consider doing that, but I'm not at that point right now.
Will you campaign against Mr. Evans other than the letter that you put out? And now I ask this knowing that last year in 2018, Mayor Bowser went out of her way to oppose your reelection. And I'm just wondering if you'll get involved in someone else's election.
So I believe the voters of Ward 2 want ethical government and ethical leadership in the Ward 2 council member. I have faith that Ward 2 voters will not return Councilmember Evans to the council.
But does that mean you will or won't get involved?
I certainly,
beyond the letters,
well,
so.
I signed the letter to say that the evidence from our investigations was clear. And that I was one of 12 members. It was a unanimous decision by the council to take the extraordinary action of expelling
Councilmember
Evans.
I know, but I'm talking about going forward, not what you've done, but what going forward. Would you get involved in a campaign for one of the candidates if you decide that person is the best person?
That would be a yes or no, because we got to get another listener in.
I'd consider it.
Okay.
Here's Perry in Brightwood. Perry, your turn.
Thank you, Kojo. Thank you, Tom. And thank you, Council Member. You have served honorably, and I thank you. Council Member, I want to ask you about the Waste Theft Prevention Act. Workers file claims, and they have to wait 60 days is the mandate, but I've got workers who have been waiting 6 months, upwards of a year. Council Member, would you support an amendment to the Waste Theft Prevention Act that speeds that process up for workers who... some get evicted while they're waiting to receive money from a wage theft situation with an employer. Would you support an amendment toward strengthening the Wage Theft Prevention Act?
So certainly wage theft is a big issue in our city. And just for listeners to understand, this is when people aren't getting paid properly for the work that they perform. We've been working with you, Perry, as you know, to do strong oversight over our wage and hour office. I'd have to take a look at the amendment to make sure I understand what it would do. But we need to make sure that workers are being paid fairly and properly. And I want to thank the Attorney General for his work in this area. He's brought a couple big lawsuits that have resulted in big settlements that have returned money to workers who have been denied the fair payment of wages.
Before we run out of time, I got to ask you about the paid family leave. It's one of your biggest achievements on the council, and it's supposed to start in July. You had a hearing recently. For people, there are hundreds of thousands of workers who may take advantage of this program. Is it going to start in July? Taxes have been collected since last summer. Is paid family leave going to be available to people in July, or will there be a delay?
The director of the Department of Employment Services says yes, that we are on target to deliver paid family leave benefits. Let me explain where we are. First, we had our tax collection process to make sure that we had money to pay the benefits. I want to say that even the Federal City Council's representative at our hearing last week said that tax collections exceeded his expectations. Now we're building out the benefits side of the program.
You're out of time. Summer jobs, is it going to work this summer? Kojo's raising his hand. You just say yes or no. Any concerns about summer jobs working well this year?
So we need it to work, and I would encourage everyone who is interested in a summer job to go to summerjobs.dc.gov.
As I said, we're almost out of time, but this is our last topic. You know what that is. This week, the council unanimously voted to make go-go the official music of the district. Is that a good thing?
It is a good thing. I think we need to celebrate our culture here in the district. I certainly remember seeing Chuck Brown, actually, and it's a great thing to celebrate. We also have other great local music here as well. It doesn't diminish those genres. Certainly, we have a great punk scene in the district, great jazz. I think we need to work on celebrating our district culture more.
Alyssa Silverman, she's an at-large member of the D.C. Council. Good to see you. Thank you for joining
us. Too short, Kojo. Too short.
Going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Wanika Fisher. She is Assistant Majority Leader in the Maryland House of Delegates. I'm Kojo Nan. Welcome back. Our guest is Juanica Fisher, Assistant Majority Leader in the Maryland House of Delegates. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's back to the future, it would appear, in the Baltimore race to succeed Elijah Cummings in the Congress of the United States, because the individual who has won that primary is Kweisi Mfume, who preceded Elijah Cummings in that position. The Republican winner was Kimberly Klasick, but it's almost assured that the Democratic winner is who's likely to go on to hold the seat.
20% Republican registration in that in the 7th District, which is Baltimore City, Baltimore County, and part of Howard County. You know, Kweisi Mfume, I was watching the election returns from the Maryland Board of Elections. I think that was the same night as the State of the Union address. Mm-hmm. And I was watching the TV for that and the computer for this. Mr. Mfume jumped out very quickly in early returns, and the returns did come in, unlike Iowa, 40%, and he stayed that way, and he defeated some well-known people. You know, he held that office from, I think, the mid-'80s to the mid-'90s, and he never relinquished his lead. He beat Maya Cummings, Elijah Cummings' widow, and State Senator Jill Carter.
And I've heard there's a possibility that if he is ultimately elected to the position, he can fall back on his seniority from the days when he was.
Well, that's my understanding.
That
you know, he will not be a freshman, and he's very well respected, I think, on the Hill. So, you know, Maryland and Baltimore certainly needs a strong member of Congress, just as Elijah Cummings was. And I think, assuming that the Republican doesn't make some miraculous change, he will be back in Congress very soon.
Are you a supporter of Kweisi Mfume?
Yes, I am. He's a lovely person. I've gotten to meet him and know him over the years through a couple of my mentors. Jolene Ivey is very close to him, and so I'm very happy to see him.
The next election is April 28th.
Tom Sherwood, we think of lawmakers in leadership positions as those who have been around for a while, but Juanica Fisher took office just a little more than a year ago. She is a fresh person in the General Assembly. How did she get to be Assistant Majority Leader?
Well, I think that's the first question we should ask her. She's, you know, you burst on the scene. You're a lawyer. You're originally from New York, but you're now in a leadership position of the General Assembly. There are some people who stay in the General Assembly for maybe decades and wish they had your position.
Well,
what happened?
How did this come about?
Well, it really happened based on our new speaker, who's really taken the position and just soared.
Adrienne Jones,
who is our Speaker of the House, she decided, instead of just appointing a House member to the Assistant Majority Leadership position, she would give the freshman class, so the new incoming delegates, a better voice at the table. So she allowed us to come up with our own process, vote amongst the class. At the time that I ran with my class, there are 41 freshmen. After our next appointment, there'll be 43 freshmen in the General Assembly. And I was honored to be selected by my colleagues. And then the speaker appointed me, and here I am.
And what is the title again?
Assistant Majority Leader.
And what do you do?
My biggest job is being a conduit for the freshman class and for the speaker to the freshman class. And I'm also there to assist our majority leader, that's in the title, Eric Lukey. He's doing a wonderful job, and I'm really learning a lot in galvanizing and leading our party's legislative issues and agendas on the floor.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself. Tom mentioned that you were born in New York. It's my understanding you came here first to attend the University of Maryland. You graduated and left. Why'd you come back?
I really came back. I miss Maryland. I think my adulthood has really been here, college and all of my years after. And I was working at the time for John Liu, who's the Comptroller of New York. And one of my mentors, I mentioned earlier, Jolene Ivey, was running for Lieutenant Governor. And she called me and she asked me to come help. I packed up my car.
The original Mocha Mom.
Yes, the original Mocha Mom. And I packed up my car. Next thing I know, I was back in Prince George's County, the county that I love, and I just never left.
A Washington Post columnist last year called you Maryland's version of AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Is that how you think of yourself?
I think that's a very large compliment. I think of myself just as Juanica from Hyattsville, Maryland. I think that I have my own ideas, and I try to do things that in my heart are the right thing. I did run against an incumbent, so I think there was a parallel there for my current seat. So I think the compliment is very high, but I'm still trying to make sure I produce results for my residents.
You are a fresh voice, and there are lots of issues. Your district borders a little of I-495 and down into, close to Hyattsville, and you have issues about what 495 is going to be like. But I want to ask you about the hot rail item that you brought up in the legislature, which is reparations. You're looking to have a Maryland commission established to address reparations. And many people will say they're for reparations, but they don't know what they mean by that, how that would work. One, do you have a chance of getting this commission done? Where is it in the legislative process? And what do you hope to see?
Well,
to address systemic racism.
Yes, I think for me, I put the legislation in to really start a conversation in Maryland. You have one of the largest black caucuses in the country. We are the state of Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. If not Maryland, where on a state level do you discuss it? I think that all legislation takes time. You know, whether we're doing any kind of bill, it's not guaranteed you're going to pass something, get it on the governor's desk in a session. So
you got to start the process.
You got to start the process. So right now, the bill's been handed into the hopper, which means it'll get a committee assignment, maybe multiple committee assignments, and we'll have a hearing, and it'll go from there. I only did the bill in the House. There's no Senate crossfile. So it would have to pass the House to actually go over to the Senate. So I think it's really in a process to unpack what Maryland needs to do under, you know, systematic racism. I think this year in the session, we're discussing the blueprint for Maryland's future. I sit on the House Judiciary Committee.
That's
and
the Kerwin
the Commission.
Education thing.
Yes. And then I sit on the House Judiciary Committee, in which I face and think about systematic issues in our criminal justice system. And I just constantly feel like sometimes we're just talking about the Band-Aids, when the underlying issue that our nation and our state has not addressed is the aftermath of slavery and how that's affected our residents and our state.
There's so many other issues, but just for reparations, some people say, well, I understand people have been mistreated, mm-hmm. and that's using the word lightly. But how does it work? Does it mean there will be preference, racial equity preference for either jobs or for lost wages or for, I mean, people, you can't really fix the horrors that occurred under slavery. But what would be some of the remedies that you would think could be done?
Yeah, some of the remedies I proposed was really about, and the biggest thing that slavery did was you took out hundreds of years of building black wealth,
right?
And a family wealth. No one's inheriting a house if they never owned one. So a lot of it has to do with, you know, free college at Maryland institutions I proposed, mm-hmm. back wage pay for your ancestors, access to a small business and home mortgage loans at a different interest rate to help those folks. So those are some of the proposals, but really the bill empowers the commission and for more minds than just me to tackle such a big issue to see what would be appropriate for Maryland to move us forward.
And that would be a one-year, two-year commission or open-ended?
I would be open-ended. Okay. I did not put any expiration to the commission in the bill.
Maryland Matters, when you were appointed to this session, said that you are the youngest African-American woman in the General Assembly, and Melissa in Laurel, Maryland, has a question related to that youth. Melissa, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Being the youngest African-American woman in the General Assembly, congratulations once again on being the Assistant Majority Leader. As legislature is a lot younger, how is that impacting legislation this session?
Well, thank you so much for that question. I think that our legislature more than ever reflects the great state of Maryland, and it's just an amazing place to work. I think it's really affecting the issues that a lot of young people care about, student loan debt, to issues around mortgages, issues around health care, as a lot of the younger members and younger female members are raising children while they're in the legislature, looking to have children while they're in the legislature. So it's really changing the atmosphere, and Speaker Jones has been really great at having all the voices at the table and really coming up with an agenda that fits everyone. So.
With the youth and with the AOC comparison and younger legislators in the General Assembly, do you think Maryland should expect an avalanche of progressive legislation coming out of Annapolis this session?
I wouldn't say an avalanche. I think there will be. I think there'll be progressive bills.
Yeah, that was my word.
Yes, we have a House and a Senate, and again, we have a Republican governor, and as you saw last week, under the great leadership of the president of our Senate, Bill Ferguson, and Speaker Jones, we had great veto overrides from the governor. So we might want to. There might be a move to move certain issues more left, but you also have to be prepared to override that veto. And so I think with that dynamic, I think you're going to see us move in a progressive agenda, but I don't think it would be an avalanche per se.
Well, one of the big issues is Governor Hogan has attacked the Kerwin Commission report on school funding, the $4 billion over the next 10 years, and called it half-baked. Mm-hmm. And the legislature itself hasn't really quite decided yet how it's going to fund it. But this is obviously education is a major issue.
Yes.
Prince George's County would benefit from this new legislation, but it also local
has concerns about how to pay for
how much money $360 million would have to be raised from Prince Georgians. Where are we? Everyone wants good education for every person.
Yes.
But where are we in funding the Kerwin report?
Yeah, so
what does the leadership say? Give us the inside scoop.
Well, I think we're all still figuring it out with all the voices on the table. I think my county executive, Angela Alsobrooks, has been very vocal on this issue.
Yes.
All of us from Prince George's County are very concerned. As I've said before, Prince George's and Baltimore City, as in a lot of issues I bring up, are the most hit by the Kerwin Commission and have the people that are most in need. So I do believe in my conversations with leadership, they're looking very hard to make sure the funding formula works for everyone and that we invest in our children.
So you could get some dispensation maybe for Prince George's and Baltimore so they won't have the hit financially that maybe Montgomery or other counties might get.
And I think they're going to be looking to make it as fair and as equitable as possible. But, you know, I always say you can either, you know, you either want to pay for the desk or you want to pay for the jail cell, right? And so there's a lot of ways in our society that Kerwin or the Blueprint for Maryland's Future is actually long-term cost saving. And being in our courts in Maryland, in session, not every week, but outside of session every week, it's important to me that we invest in our children and we invest on the front end of people's future and not
Speaking
on the back
of that,
end.
What type of law work do you do?
I used to be a prosecutor, but I do criminal defense and personal injury work.
Speaking of Governor Hogan, the relationship between him and Democrats, he doesn't speak to us at all, but this week he said that in his State of the State address, he contrasted Maryland's relatively civil political climate with the country's divisive one. Do you think he's right about that? There is goodwill?
I think in Maryland, I don't think the governor is right. I think he is giving his perspective as our Constitution makes, even with the budget and everything else, we're a very governor-heavy state. I do think that holding the majority, I think we treat Republicans with respect. We try to consensus build and work together. But when it comes to serving the people of Maryland, we get it done. And I think that the governor, honestly, puts out the most animosity and controversy and issues more than the leadership in the House and the Senate when it comes to how he is critical, the issues that he says.
Calling the Kerwin Commission
half-baked. Exactly. And I don't think Exactly. And I don't
threatening tax increases and things that the Democrats have said they are not going to do. I think the Senate President, Mr. Ferguson, said there will not be any major tax increases this year.
Exactly. So it seems like the sharp words tend to come from him a lot.
Have you ever sat down with the governor? Has he spoken to you directly on any issue?
No. The only time
he hasn't been on this program either.
No.
We're all in the same boat here.
The only time I've interacted with him is big events. So I've never had the chance to personally speak with
the governor. Here is Amber in Maryland. Amber, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. How are you? Thank you so much for taking me today. So actually, I was calling in because I did hear about a bill that was going to be introduced by Delegate Fisher that would stop mass layoffs with our companies. I recently went through something dealing with that with Shoppers Food Pharmacy, and it devastated a lot of us. And we didn't actually have severance packages in our contract. So those things had to be renegotiated down towards the end of the line, but it was just devastating to see so many thousands of people lose their jobs, health benefits, and things of that sort. So my question today was, how would this bill be able to help out myself and my fellow associates and also stop these type of things from happening to workers down the line?
Think. Oh. Thank you, Amber.
Anika Fisher?
Yes, thank you, Amber, so much for that question. The bill is the Economic Stabilization Act that I'm working on with Delegate Davis. It's really in response to shoppers, as Amber, as you stated, of with their mass layoffs. And it's really common sense protections when a big company like that is laying off workers here in the state of Maryland when it comes to notice, when it comes to the severance package. You know, I was saying to someone the other day, in Maryland, we don't break up via text. You need to come to my house, bring my stuff in a box, and tell me in person. So if I had to say in a quick sentence what the bill does, that's basically it. And I think it's the right thing to do. And I'm happy to be the co-sponsor of that legislation in economic matters.
I mentioned transportation earlier, the governor's $9 billion plan. He's made some adjustments after Montgomery and Prince George's all complained about how mm-hmm. he was starting it, what was going to be done first, where the homes are going to be taken. What is the impact on, again, your district borders part of 495? What is the impact you see on Prince George's County on these changes to 495?
It's really a lot of it's a lot of congestion issues and finding pathways in our traffic system that work for our residents.
What are you for?
I am not for highway expansion. I'm for us investing in transit that's going to be good for the environment and go forward. We haven't even had Purple Line come out and see the effects of Purple Line and how it's going to relieve congestion. You know, I think you have to address problems as they come, keep our environment in the front of our minds as we're going forward. You know, we need to also have a change of getting Marylanders out of their cars for their commutes. And I think that, you know, the governor's proposal isn't the right thing for my district. I know my district is we're very turned upside down with the Purple Line construction, but we're happy that it's here. I always say my district's tiny but not mighty. We're very intense. We're a tiny district.
It's a very tight, small district, 47B.
Yes, we're very tight. So we have an intense residency, and we want to make sure that we're doing the best that we can to move people with the least disruption as possible.
We have about a minute left, but one of your House colleagues has introduced a campaign finance bill that would allow some Prince George's County officials to accept campaign contributions from developers. That's mm-hmm. allowed in other Maryland counties. What do you think of this idea?
I have to take more time to look at it. I do think that laws in Maryland should be the same for everyone. If I'm in Prince George's, Baltimore, Wicomico County, or Montgomery, we should all be under the same restrictions and rules on campaign finance. So I do think that we need to look at it holistically as a state and make sure that we're all on the same page.
This is a hangover from Jack Johnson.
Yes.
And that's what it is, because he was corrupt. This was passed, and you guys are at a disadvantage when it comes to raising money. Angela Alsobrooks may run for governor. Are you going to support her?
I think Angela's doing a great job as our county executive, and I'm excited to see what she has in the future, for sure.
Do you have a person in mind that you don't want to mention, or she's just on your potential list?
Oh, yeah, for sure she's on my potential list, and I think people are so focused on our upcoming presidential race that there haven't been clear candidates, so it's really hard for me to comment not knowing the field, and we're so far away from that.
What about president, Democratic primary, do you support any of the Democrats yet?
Yes, I do. I've already come out in supporting Joe Biden.
Okay.
And that's about all the time we have. Wanika Fisher is Assistant Majority Leader in the Maryland House of Delegates. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Today's show is produced by Lauren Marco. Mark your calendar for the next Coder in Your Community conversation. We'll talk about changing immigration rules and their impact on local students and families. That's on February 25th at the Columbia Heights Educational Campus. Learn how to get tickets and more at kojoshow.org. Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, why are D.C. Girl Scouts doing their best to get the endangered little brown bat named D.C. state mammal? You have any opinions on this, Tom Sherwood?
No.
You don't know?
No.
And if the little brown bat gets named D.C. state mammal, what's going to happen to the big brown bat? What do you plan on doing this weekend?
My income taxes.
Oh, really? That shouldn't take long at all.
It's all a paperwork.
Because we're not paying you anything here. So. I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Join us at noon on Monday. Until then, have a wonderful weekend. I'm Kojo Nam.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sydney Grannon, Lauren Marco, and Victoria Chamberlain. Our managing producer is Mana Kashvi. Our engineer is Ben Privet. Our intern is Richard Cunningham. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.